I'd like now to welcome scientist Simon DeDeo. He's trained as an astrophysicist, and now he's working in biological and social systems at the Santa Fe Institute, where he is an Omidyar Fellow. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So we're talking today about the phenomenon of Wikipedia and taking a look at two kinds of organizations. On the one hand, the top-down organizations that have leaders and plans and executives, and on the other hand, self-organizing, leaderless, bottom-up organizations. And we'll talk about all that in a moment. But first of all, let's talk about where we are. We're at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this is a place where scientists from all kinds of different disciplines work together across disciplines to accomplish things that they could not do if they were taking a more specialized approach. You yourself being an example of this, having gone from physics and astrophysics into the social sciences and biological sciences. Mm-hmm. How do you all work together and use each other's tools to mutual benefit?
There's a big set of questions behind that, I think, seemingly simple question. Every discipline has its own rules, its own set of concepts that you learn, in some sense, very early in your career, and they seem like the most natural ways to view the world. The joke in physics is that every system in physics is a loaded spring or the hydrogen atom. And of course, if you talk to a sociologist, they have a completely different way of dividing up the phenomena they see. And so one of the first things that you have to do, I think, when you start to collaborate with people who not only didn't share your same department, but may not even share your same conceptual space, is to figure out how they divide up the world. There's a secondary set of questions, which is that we also are trained in different methods. So even if two fields do statistics, they may often do very different kinds of statistics with very different kinds of philosophies behind them. So you can have technical questions that you battle out. But I think the most challenging part and the most fruitful part of our work at the Institute is in sharing concepts, adapting the concepts that you were raised with, and bringing new concepts into your own world.
And so we're going to talk about a social system and a number of social systems, Wikipedia being one of them. But when you are looking at the social sciences as a discipline, here you are studying groups of people. And I mean, you come from physics. It's one thing to study the behavior of water or planets, mm-hmm. or photons. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about people who are infinitely complicated and varied genetically and culturally and so on, how can you use the tools of science, which are all about making predictions and seeing things that can happen in a consistent way? How do you use that on people or in groups of people?
One of the tricks of science, I think, is to explain and predict what you're able to explain and predict. And so even in the physical sciences, there is an enormous amount of stuff that we're not able to predict, that we essentially average out as randomness, we consider to be noise. And we consider it not interesting, not because it's essentially not interesting, but because we can't do anything with it. So even in what you might call the exact sciences, which have a reputation for making predictions of unbelievable accuracy, we spend a lot of time throwing out or ignoring or postponing discussions of things that we don't have a handle on yet.
Is there an example?
One example from high school physics, of course, is the phenomena of friction. So the inclined plane is sort of a standard thing that you often train nascent physicists on. The source of friction is a mystery. It's itself an entire topic. If you become a mechanical engineer, presumably you spend a lot of time thinking about friction. One thing, for example, is what is rolling friction? When a ball rolls, say, down an inclined plane, how is that phenomenon of friction different from the sliding of a block? So even in the most simple systems, we spend a lot of time averaging over things we don't understand. If you go to, say, some of the most successful exact sciences, so particle physics is an example, all of particle physics involves averaging over, the technical term is renormalizing, over fluctuations, over things that are happening at scales that to us are a complete mystery. So string theory, for example, is an attempt to kind of pull back the curtain another level down in the sciences of electrons, photons, the fundamental particles. But even there, physicists, one hopes at least, are emotionally comfortable with not knowing the inside of the things they study. They want to know the inside, but at the same time, we can still make progress in what you might say is sort of average sense.
Which is so interesting because we, on the outside, so to speak, have this illusion, perhaps, that these things are, particularly in physics, these things are well understood.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think about psychology. For almost as long as we've had a tradition in the sciences, we've wanted to understand why people do what they do. And we take, for example, Freud or Jung, who claim that they've uncovered some unbelievable, fascinating structure just below our conscious lives that informs and dictates everything we do. That may or may not be true. It depends, I suppose. You have to ask the people who practice in therapy, who practice as social workers. But at the same time, we make ordinary progress every day. I don't have to know some of the depth of psychology in order to predict what's going to happen if I don't call my mother 3 days in a row. I don't need a profound theory of psychology to tell me how to behave in an ordinary social situation. So even though the underlying mechanisms are often hidden from us, and even though, for example, establishing just a single part of one mechanism would be an enormous intellectual accomplishment for anybody, even though those things are so hard, yet we can still make progress. We still put sort of nails in the wall that allow us to get up.
So let's talk about the social sciences. To what extent can we understand social behavior in scientific terms? I mean, how are you guys working?
There's been a huge variety of approaches in the social sciences to try to understand. Essentially, the fundamental question is why do people do what they do? Why do the worlds that we inhabit, which are so structured by our social systems, why do they have the look that they do? I was reading a wonderful article by Sam Bowles, one of our faculty here, who describes a Spanish conquistador who looks and describes what's happening in the Aztec kingdom they've just found. And he describes a marketplace. So there's a marketplace, and he's able to recognize this phenomena, which is amazing because they've never had contact before. So why on earth did two totally separate civilizations both invent something that pretty much looks like people selling rugs, counting money, counting their goods, weighing them, you know, having beliefs about who's trustworthy, who's not trustworthy? All those phenomena seem to show up over and over again. And they're not just about a shared history. There seem to be some fundamental social principles underlying those. And that's a profound mystery. Somehow, and it's not the case, for example, that a particular kind of free market economy is the only thing that will happen, and we're all destined to do that any more than the future of the world is going to be a Marxist future. But there are certain fundamental patterns that seem to arise over and over again. And so those are the kind of units that we're trying to describe, trying to explain, trying to describe their function. So, for example, you might, just as a doctor tries to describe the function of a liver, you might try to describe the function of a free market. And then you also might try to describe its origins. So an evolutionary biologist will look at human organs and try to figure out where do they come from. Can we look at the history of life and figure out when these different innovations showed up?
And somebody looking at marketplaces will try to figure out what it is in primate systems that is the precursor to a market.
Well, that's an absolutely fantastic example, because our social systems not only extend into our deep history, but they extend even further before we were people. Back when we were indeed social animals of a very different sort in the evolutionary tree.
So what are some ways in which, again, the tools of science and mathematics have been used, maybe some simple examples, to understand social systems and social interactions?
So this is not quite, I think, the answer you want to hear, or the answer your listeners might want to hear. But I think some of the greatest examples of the use of mathematics, and in fact scientific theories in the social sciences, most of those examples are examples of failures. Now, of course, some of the failures are really informative. They tell us a great deal about what's going on. But so far, we've built an enormous number of theories. And in the 20th century, those theories became increasingly mathematical in character. But I think they've also let us down repeatedly. So one example is game theory. During the Cold War, game theory was invented in part to understand the actions of the Soviet Union with respect to the United States. So we were in a very high-stakes situation. We had a small number of actors, right? In this case, two. And we wanted to understand, if we made a certain kind of move, we being the Americans, let's say, made a certain kind of move, how would the Soviets respond? What would be the most rational thing for them to do? And in the development of that game theory, we came across these sort of fundamental mathematical structures. We learned, for example, about what's called the prisoner's dilemma, which is one of the classic examples of cooperation when cooperation is dangerous. We learned a great deal about, for example, what's called the Nash equilibrium, which is supposedly the most rational way to behave. And what's amazing about that intellectual endeavor is the fact that it continually fails to predict actual human behavior. So people don't behave the way the mathematics that we had says they should behave. And why that's the case, I mean, there's some beautiful reasons why that is the case. And so in some sense, a theory that's failed, if it fails in a particularly interesting way, which I think something like game theory has, if a theory fails, you can actually learn a great deal. Some theories, they fail, and they fail in ways that are profoundly uninformative. They were badly phrased, they weren't really scientific, they had sort of hidden ideological assumptions. But game theory, I think, is an example, one of the most common examples of a way to rigorously predict human behavior. The problem is that the predictions of game theory over and over again have failed.
Would you like to give an example of, for example, what prisoner's dilemma is and how people don't conform to what you would think would be good rational choices?
Prisoner's dilemma is one of the classic examples. Let me give you an even simpler example that it's sort of stunning in the simplicity of the example, the intuitive nature of the prediction, and the failure in the real world. And so this is a game, it's called the ultimatum game. So game theory is all about, essentially, it's almost always about two-player games, sometimes more than two players, but just think of it as two people facing each other across a table. And the ultimatum game, it sounds so trivial, but here we go. There's $100 on the table. And so you, Mary Charlotte, and me, Simon, are playing. You're given $100. And you propose a division. So you'll say, Simon, I'm going to keep $90 and you'll get 10. And your stage of the game is now over and it's my move. And I can make one of two moves. I can either say, okay, I'll accept the offer you make. Or I can say, no, I don't want it. I don't want your stupid money, go away. So
in which case you get nothing.
In which case both of us get nothing.
Ah,
you get nothing,
okay.
I get nothing. The $100 goes to UNICEF, let's say. Maybe not UNICEF, it gets burned. So the ultimatum game is, it's funny, when I teach, I often ask students, let's just play the ultimatum game. So would you like to play?
Okay.
Okay, so you have $100. How will you split it?
50-50.
Absolutely. You got it. Done deal. This makes intuitive sense to us. From a game theoretic point of view, from a mathematical point of view, it makes no sense. Any offer you make me above zero, I should accept. If you offer me $1, why would I throw away $1? Just take the money. Take the money and leave. And so the sort of optimal strategy from the prediction of the mathematicians is you should just maximize your outcome. And so what that means is you should take whatever offers on the table because something is always better than nothing. And yet your intuition, and of course my intuition as well, is that we have all of these social norms, we have all of these cultural things that predispose us towards fairness.
Now, for example, with the ultimatum game, has it been studied how people of different cultures play that game?
Absolutely. So this is one of the wonderful results is not only do people play the ultimatum game in a way that violates the mathematical prediction, but different cultures and different groups play the game in different ways. So our notion of fairness is shared by and large with many communities in the world. In fact, most communities that use the free market and interact with strangers. But isolated communities, for example, communities where you interact almost entirely with your family and not with people outside of your kin group, they tend to play the ultimatum game with a lower offer to the other player. There's so many complexities here. So for example, you can imagine the social status of the two players might matter. So imagine instead of having two equals, you had an employee and a boss. So the boss might say, you know what? You're great. Have 90. I'll just take 10. I don't need it. And the employee would say, you're a great boss, thank you. But if the employee says to his boss, you take 90 and I'll take 10, the boss say, who do you think you are? So there's all sorts of complicated cultural, social, psychological aspects to the game. And these things, not only they're not small perturbations to how we act. They seem to be the dominant perturbation to how we act. And really, it seems like what we're understanding is that while the game theoretic models are telling us something, they make a prediction. They make a scientifically rigorous prediction. So they're helpful in that sense. It's just they haven't yet captured the social nature, the contextual nature, perhaps the historical nature of how we actually make decisions.
I was going to say, I mean, with that game, a lot would depend on whether I think I'm going to see you tomorrow.
Absolutely. So one of the sort of foundational aspects many people think of communities is the fact that you have repeated interactions. And one place you might look for purely game theoretic behaviors is where you don't expect to see the other person. So, for example, people driving in traffic in large cities. You don't even know who's behind the wheel generally. All you just see are these looming cars in front of you. And so, in fact, it was funny. I had a lovely conversation with Don Ross, who's an economist, a game theorist, who studied the game theory of, so the light's turning yellow. Do you speed up or do you slow down? And so one of the problems they had in Canada was Ottawa, the capital of Canada, had a huge number of traffic accidents that were happening when the light was turning yellow. And the question is why? Don went through and did a game theoretic analysis of the problem. And it turns out that there are mathematically two optimal strategies here, which you can kind of guess, right? One strategy is you speed up and you try and make it. And then, of course, if you're the guy waiting for the yellow light to turn red so you can go, you make sure that no one's coming. And vice versa, if the light's turning yellow, you slow down. And the thing about Ottawa is that it actually has a lot of people who come from either Montreal or Toronto. And in Montreal or Toronto, they've settled on two different behavioral patterns, one of the two predicted by game theory. And that works fine if you're in Toronto because everyone has the same set of rules. It's all optimal, and it works fine in Montreal. But when these two sets of drivers show up in Ottawa, they have different conventions and they have car accidents.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's a fascinating story. And so it isn't that game theory has failed completely. But the idea that game theory would be, in some sense, the hydrogen atom, right, the base theory upon which all of us could build more elaborate social theories, that hasn't seemed to play out. It may be the case that game theories phrased in slightly different ways that refer to groups, perhaps, as opposed to individuals, might be more powerful. But that's an area of current research. It's a fascinating area. But when you ask, give us an example of a mathematical theory that works in the social sciences, that we use in the social sciences, what's sort of exciting, what's, I think, one of the reasons why many people are now coming into the social sciences is because we don't have those theories. It's a little bit as if we're in the 1850s in physics, even the 1550s in physics. We haven't yet settled on the right ways to talk about human behavior that are not ideological, that respect the data, that make predictions, and that somehow accord with what we see in the real world.
We're talking to Santa Fe Institute scientist Simon DeDeo. So let's turn now to this example of Wikipedia, which is a sprawling, fascinating system that is a product of the internet, is essentially an anonymous encyclopedia written by who knows who. I guess we know something, but basically a person can write a piece on Wikipedia. They don't get money for it. Their name is not attached to it. Mm-hmm. And it is now perhaps as accurate or almost as accurate as the best encyclopedias in the world and far more comprehensive with how many entries are there in the thing at this point?
Right. So Wikipedia is an unbelievable phenomenon. There's about 5 million articles currently online. That number changes, of course, every hour, every day. As you say, it's edited largely by not only people, not only do we not know who they are, but they can change their identities essentially as they like. So they rarely use their real names. In fact, there's almost, I would say, a social norm against using your real name on Wikipedia. There's quality control only in the sense that other anonymous or pseudonymous users can see and react to what you do. And as you say, the encyclopedia is not only enormously comprehensive, but by and large, it's as accurate or nearly as accurate as rigorous ancient institutions. And so the obvious example to compare Wikipedia to is the Encyclopedia Britannica. Encyclopedia Britannica is at least a century old. It has an unbelievably distinguished board of editors. It's an institution that's outlasted, of course, it's outlasted its first generation of editors. And in a recent study, so this was actually a study not so recent now, in 2005, they compared the accuracy of Wikipedia and the Encyclopedia Britannica. So these are two completely different models for how to organize information, how to verify it, how to collect it, collate it, edit it. And what they found was that Wikipedia is nearly at parity with the Encyclopedia Britannica in terms of major and minor errors. So these are certainly, if you're a game theorist, Wikipedia makes no sense. Why would people act altruistically for free? They have no reputational effects beyond the encyclopedia itself. If I edit something on Wikipedia, I don't get promoted at work. I certainly don't get paid. I'm talking to people whose real names I don't know. So it's not a networking thing. I don't gain business contacts by working on Wikipedia. I have no way to benefit from my own expert knowledge. So I have a PhD in astrophysics, but when I edit the article on galactic dynamics, I have the same status as any other user in the world. I have the same legitimacy, I have the same right to preserve my edits as somebody who, for example, may never have opened an astronomy textbook in their life. So all of these facts about Wikipedia suggest that it's going to be a disaster.
Right.
This is just going to be the cesspit of the internet. And what's amazing, and one of the reasons that we decided to take a closer look at what's going on, is that it hasn't. It's actually become an extremely high-functioning social system. And a social system that organized itself on a much more rapid time scale than the societies that you and I live in the physical world. So how long did it take us to invent a legal system? How long did it take us to invent an economy, a structure for our cities, a way to govern ourselves? Many hundreds of years, if not thousands. But Wikipedia went from nothing, from desert, right, to megalopolis in about 10 years. And essentially what it allows us to do is see a speeded up version of how people take themselves from a state of nature, as Hobbes might say, from a state of nature to a state of culture, of society, of community.
And it's also in a context, namely the internet, where there is such a huge amount of nonsense and infighting and sort of lowest common denominator stuff. And Wikipedia seems to be exactly the opposite. It brings out the best in everybody. It brings out their desire to improve things. I mean, there is some vandalism, but the result seems to be the opposite of the kind of sites where people are continually bickering with each other.
Wikipedia is not a utopia. There's bad behavior. There's conflict. In fact, it may be the case, and you can make this case, that a certain level of conflict is good for the institution of Wikipedia, for the culture of Wikipedia. The idea that conflict, sort of the flip side of cooperation, is a healthy thing is something that Jessica Flack and David Krakauer and a number of my colleagues have worked on. The idea, however, seems to be that, I mean, consider life in Santa Fe. There's a great deal of antisocial behavior in Santa Fe. You read the newspaper and you can see theft, murder, vandalism. And yet, by and large, Santa Fe works. You, by and large, feel safe. You know how to live in Santa Fe. It is not a major stressor to be a citizen here. And in the same way in Wikipedia, it is not a perfect place. And yet it's managed to be a functioning society that gets things done in the same way Santa Fe is able to get things done. And so perhaps what's surprising about it is that it looks like an ordinary town. An ordinary town that came from nowhere in 10 years.
Right. So how do you explain it?
I'd love to give you an explanation. We don't have one. We've looked at aspects of the system. We've begun our studies. Certainly, if we had an explanation of why Wikipedia functioned as well as it did, if we had a scientific explanation, we would be much further along, I think, in our sort of evolution as a social species. If we could actually answer these questions, why is this society healthy? Why is this community healthy? And why is that community unhealthy? Why is that community falling apart? You cross a border in the world, and two towns that are 10 kilometers away from each other will have completely different worlds. They'll have completely different homicide rates. They'll have completely different levels of domestic violence. Even if the towns have been exchanging people for centuries, so there's no racial difference, there's no genetic difference. So if we could explain why one culture, one group succeeds and another doesn't, I think we would be happier as people. We would have less crime. We would have better schools. We would have a healthier environment. If we could solve, for example, the problem of cooperation on a global scale, which Wikipedia, in some sense, has been able to do, right? So Wikipedia is not geographically restricted. It isn't restricted by family or where you live. If we could even get part of an answer, I think, there from these studies, they would be worth their weight in gold. That's the larger statement.
I mean, isn't that what you social scientists are trying to do?
Well, so I wouldn't call myself yet a social scientist. I would say I'm exploring this world. I've been working in this field for 4 years or so. And so to call myself a social scientist seems a bit pretentious. But I think for almost as long as we've had the social sciences, even in their sort of folk form, even in their philosophical form, going back to, say, Aristotle, as long as you've had the social sciences, we've wanted not just to explain what's going on, but of course use that knowledge to produce better societies, to construct better societies. And for example, if you look at the discussions that people like Franklin and Thomas Jefferson had, Alexander Hamilton had, about how to build the Constitution of the United States, how to set up that structure. They're asking questions. They're asking social scientific questions. And it's actually beautiful to go back and see how much they actually looked at the data. It's interesting to see, for example, Thomas Jefferson, when he's in France, is corresponding with French scientists, French demographers, about how long do people live? What's the mortality curve for people? Because he wants to know how to set up a real society in his home country. So we've always had these sort of dual goals of explanation and prediction, let's say, but also control and also sort of manipulation. We would, if we can explain why things are wrong, the hope is that we can make them better. So that's one answer. Now, we can certainly talk about particular events that happen. We can certainly talk about particular effects. We can talk about large-scale mathematical patterns that arise. I don't think we're at the place yet where we can have an explanation for the success, this brute force variable, this extremely successful system. I can give you an anecdote. So if you look at the level of cooperation on the encyclopedia over time, if you look at how well people are able to coordinate the actions that they're taking when they're editing an article in Wikipedia. You see, so when the encyclopedia started in sort of 2000, 2001, all the editors by and large behaved extremely well. They may not have been great editors, some of them were, of course, but they certainly weren't fighting with each other.
Now, was it already at the very beginning, just anybody mm-hmm. who wanted to write an article on Kropotkin or astrophysics could do so?
By and large, by 2002, 2003, that's the case. The very early history, I mean, it's sort of surprising. The idea of the Wikipedia is so crazy that it's hard to say actually when it actually happened, because the idea of just letting it go and saying, you know what, just open it up, anyone can edit, which is the sort of the logo on the top of the encyclopedia. When that exactly happens, I actually don't know the answer to that. But somewhere by 2001, 2002, certainly by 2003, that principle is enshrined. And so at that point, you have the mystery. But at that point as well, you have a high level of cooperation. Very little conflict is happening at that point in the encyclopedia. But over time, what happens is that people begin to fight. The user base gets larger and larger and larger. The number of topics people are taking up gets larger and larger. We move from, for example, covering mathematical questions to covering political questions. And so the most edited article, for example, in the encyclopedia today is the article about George W. Bush, which has about 45,000 edits. So 45,000 times in the last 12 years, people have written and edited each other's work on the encyclopedia on the topic of our former president. So what happens over time, and you can look, you see this right in the data, is that the amount of conflict rises, and it rises pretty quickly. And so by around about 2005, for example, 2006, the encyclopedia has become a much more conflict-based system. People are arguing much more. And that's, interestingly, right about the same time as people are discovering the fact that Wikipedia is an amazing system. So right about that same time, for example, you have the first scientific articles being written about the surprising accuracy of the system. There's also questions about whether the encyclopedia is going to survive. At that point, the amount of conflict, especially on a page such as that referring to George W. Bush, is so high that, in fact, most of what's going on is either vandalism or people arguing, and arguing in an unconstructive way about what's happening. And just to be very explicit, what that means is that people are undoing what other people are doing. So I'll put in a sentence about George W. Bush. Someone else will go in and just undo it, take that sentence right back out. And so that kind of sort of zero-sum behavior is dominating many parts of the Wikipedia. And overall, you can see it just in the overall statistics of what's going on.
And so you have these arguments going on, and yet they're still different from the kind of arguments where, for example, at the end of a newspaper article online, you see people really going at each other in ways that are mean-spirited and very unpleasant. I mean, they're very hard to read. Mm-hmm. Whereas on Wikipedia, you can't see the process unless you're following it very closely or unless you're involved mm-hmm. in it, because mm-hmm. it's undoing stuff. And if you didn't know it was there before, you'd never even know.
Exactly, yeah. So there is, in some sense, a secret history of Wikipedia. And maybe one way to say the sort of the surprise or the paradox is that if you look at the article on Bush, it's a pretty good article. It's well-sourced. It's well-written, by and large. It's factual. It's as if it was written by a college student, but a college student from Mars. So a college student totally uninvested in one of the most controversial leaders in the 21st century. How on earth a system was able to produce that. And if you look at the secret history, right, you look at who's actually making the edits and how those edits are being made, it's certainly not being written by college students from Mars. It's being written by college students from New York and Massachusetts and Alabama. It's being written by college students in Iraq. It's being written by people who are incredibly invested in the topic and in a particular story about the topic. Another way to put it is this. Most articles on Wikipedia are the first, second, or third hit for that title on Google. So if you Google George W. Bush, the article on Wikipedia will not only show up on the first page, it'll show up very near the top of all
the
results.
And if you Google hamsters, same thing.
If you Google hamsters, you Google Hamlet. These articles not only are highly edited, not only are they reasonably accurate, but they're also occupying the prime real estate on the internet. If you wanted to buy an advertisement, say during the political campaigns in, let's say, 2004, if you wanted to buy an ad for George W. Bush and have it show up on the top of the Google page, I don't know how much that ad would cost, but my guess is it would cost a great deal. And so the article itself is not only emotionally charged. What does the article say about George Bush? That matters to people a great deal because they have strong political viewpoints. But it's also economically extremely valuable. To control what that article says is to control essentially one of the most valuable billboards in the world.
And yet nobody has total control.
That's what's crazy. Nobody controls the central square. Maybe that's the way to put it. Nobody controls Speaker's Corner. The most visited place, the most popular destination for factual information, is in some sense owned and controlled by no one. Now, there are certain sort of formal mechanisms, right? Somebody has to pay for the hosting, someone has to pay for the hard drives. But if you look at the day-to-day practice of generating content, debating content, putting it on the encyclopedia, if you look at that day-to-day process, it's a hierarchy that's so flat, it's not a hierarchy. It's a relationship between equals. Now, moral equals, emotional equals, intellectual equals, not necessarily, but formally, the structure of the software is stuff that we're all equal.
There are rules that have emerged that guide how you can use Wikipedia. What are some of those rules and how did they emerge?
So if I were to be bolder and give you what I think is an explanation for the success of Wikipedia, and this is something that I don't have ironclad scientific proof for it, but if you were to ask me what's really going on there, I think the suggestion that it's about emergent rules, social norms, so not laws, not legislation enforced by somebody with enormous amounts of power. Although there are certain limit cases that happen in the encyclopedia where there is a formal power that comes in and steps in. So for example, there were problems with biographies of living people. At that point, the encyclopedia decided that in cases where especially a private individual was being slandered on the encyclopedia, they could step in right away and just turn it off, shut it down. And that would be a sort of office action. That would be something that happened sort of hidden in the bowels of the Wikipedia hierarchy. But by and large, those things are extremely rare. And so the way people govern themselves on Wikipedia is not through laws. There's not really a police force. There's a lot of sort of scolding ants, is another way to put it, right? There's a lot of social norms that people have agreed are good ways to behave and are willing to talk about, are willing to share those norms. They're willing to enforce them. Again, they can't enforce them through any kind of, you know, in the real world, through violence, right? There's no special powers they have except suasion, moral suasion. But those rules have worked extremely well. And one of the questions, I think, one of the answers to how Wikipedia, in some sense, survived this crucial period is the emergence and assertion and agreement on those norms. So
what
one example. Yeah, so perfect, exactly. So one example is, and all these norms, all these rules have cute abbreviations because it is the internet. So NPOV, NPOV, neutral point of view. So every article should take a neutral point of view. And so that social norm means that, for example, when the article describes female genital mutilation, that's a subject that most of us feel extremely strongly about. We don't think that there's any question about the moral goodness of this action. And yet, the story on Wikipedia is, because of this social norm, the way that practice is described is in a morally neutral tone. You're allowed to report about what groups say about it, but the article itself can't take a moral position on that practice. That's a tough norm to uphold. FGM is a classic example of where people really have to sit down and say, even though all of us sitting here are disgusted, the article can't express that. Neutral point of view comes into play when you talk about George Bush. So one way for that system to fall apart, one way for the consensus about how that article looks to fall apart could be as if it turned into a debate about whether George Bush was a good or bad president. Because there's many people who would say he was a bad president. There's many people who say he was an excellent president. It depends what the surveys say, of course, at any moment. But because of this norm of the neutral point of view, and because of its widespread nature, we're able to have an article on Bush that doesn't have to have that debate. It can certainly report what people say. Another example is AGF, Wikipedia AGF, which is assume good faith. So precisely because you're interacting with people who you know only by their username, and their username is not their real name, it certainly doesn't have their phone number, right? It's often a cool-sounding username, you know, sort of Wikipedia Voyager 67. Because you only interact with these people over text, through a textual medium, it's very easy to assume they're bad people. When they do something you don't like, it's very easy to attribute not just differences of opinion, but differences of moral value. And so AGF was, it's a very strong norm that says if you're in a fight with somebody, if you're in a debate over the content of an article with somebody, you shouldn't tell them that they're behaving in a way that suggests they're not a good person.
Do you have the opportunity to do that?
For every article on Wikipedia, there's also what's called a talk page. So next to the George Bush page, you click one button, and there's a discussion page where people debate the nature of the article. So, for example, one of the sample bits of data I used to calibrate the study that we did recently was on March 21st, 2006, somebody was unsure about whether or not you should describe the former president as having been honorably discharged from his service in the Air Force National Guard. And that sentence was taken out. Presumably somebody thought that saying he was honorably discharged maybe made him look too good. I have no idea, but that kind of debate can then be taken to the talk page where someone says, why did you take this out? This probably should stay in. I noticed you took it out. I put it back in. We're in conflict. Let's talk about it. So in those discussions, one of the social norms is that you should strive as far as possible, and even in the face of all contradictory evidence, that the person you're talking with is an unbelievably rational, kind-hearted, and generous spirit.
And that seems to work.
It seems to work partly. Often it fails. Right? If it worked all the time, you wouldn't need to have it as a norm. It would be, in some sense, a utopia. The social norm says when things get tough, you should still do it.
Right.
And does that work? In my own experience, and this is not a scientific statement, but in my own experience editing the encyclopedia, it works very well.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that it also works in real life.
Well, I was going to say, the first two things that you have mentioned, maintain a neutral point of view and assume good faith, are reasonable rules for polite society.
Absolutely. There are also rules that are violated continually in politics. They're violated in Washington. They're violated in newspapers. They're violated, unfortunately, in our own social lives. They make us perhaps less happy because they are violated. What's amazing is that Wikipedia, for some reason, has managed to create these norms and by and large stick by them. So another way to think of it is, yes, these are good ways to behave. Wikipedia and the people on the system, because all of these norms are not, they're not handed down, right? They're rather, in some sense, emergent and agreed upon. So some norms are proposed and rejected. An example of a norm that's rejected, by and large, has been disagreed with, is the idea that there is a deadline or a final version. So you're editing encyclopedia. It's very reasonable to say, okay, when are we done? You know, when should we stop editing the article on, well, for example, pi, the transcendental number pi? Right. It is very unlikely that we're going to have interesting new facts about pi show up. I mean, it might show up in some good equations, but by and large, the article on pi is done. Right? There's a question there as to whether one of the principles of editing should be that we strive for a final version. And a great deal of debate centered around this question as to whether or not we should freeze the encyclopedia. At some point, could we say this article is so good, we're done? And the community, in fact, many senior members, many people who had been on the encyclopedia for a long time, and in fact, many people who were some of the early funders, right, that Wikipedia emerged from, were in favor of that. By and large, the community said no. My sense as to why they said no, I don't have a strong answer, I don't have a scientific answer. My sense as to why the community said no is because it made cooperation harder. If there was going to be a final version, there would be a fight over control of that final version. But as we said in the example of the ultimatum game, if there's repeated interactions, if the game never ends, right? If we're always interacting with each other, there's perhaps a greater incentive to cooperate. And that's something actually the game theorists know. So the difference between a one-shot game, a game you only play once, and a game you play, say, 10 times and stop, those situations are very different from games where the interactions go on essentially forever, where you don't know when they're going to end. And so Wikipedians, by and large, rejected the idea of a final version.
It seems to me also that perhaps there is an acknowledgement or understanding that there is no perfection, and one generation or one group can bring a new perspective to something that you thought was locked in.
I think that's a lovely thought. I think the choice or the community consensus that exists certainly supports it. I don't know the origin. I would love to say that there is this sort of Buddhist spirit of, you know, being okay with imperfection that exists in the community. I would guess perhaps that it's a rather practical thing.
Yeah.
There's, you know, when you see something that works as well as Wikipedia, you often ask, well, you know, are the motives behind it themselves good? If you see a wise society, is it necessarily composed of wise men and women? And in the case of Wikipedia, there is a great deal of social wisdom there. Social memory, good behavior. I'm not sure that Wikipedia is composed of philosophers and saints. There's the question of which norms are adopted by the encyclopedia. Some of them, I think the assume good faith example is absolutely something that we should do on the phone, in person. There are some, I think, counterintuitive norms that have come up. So one thing is Wikipedia is not a democracy. This is a norm. And we think of democracies as, especially in the West, we think of them as the only way to organize anything. But it quickly became apparent that democracies, which of course involve voting, compromise, majority rule, are not really the right way to get at the truth of, say, a mathematical fact. We know, for example, that most Americans and majority of Americans think that the sun goes around the earth. So if we took a vote, our astronomy articles would be pretty bad. So, well,
is that true? The majority of Americans think that the sun goes around the earth?
That's a statistic that I've heard. So just to be clear, the earth doesn't go around the sun. They both go around their common center of mass, but that's a more technical point. The thing that what people discovered and was that if you want to build an information if you want to build a system of information, you shouldn't necessarily use, let's say, the federal system of voting, majority rule, right, checks and balances, that some political aspects are not useful. And so while voting does in some cases in effect happen, by and large, calling a vote is not a social norm. In fact, if you try to call a vote on something, you will be in some sense shunned. If you want, for example, to call a vote on whether you should say George Bush is the worst president, and you try and call a vote on the talk page, your suggestion will be rejected, even by people who may share your political views.
So you, here at the Santa Fe Institute, have studied Wikipedia and attempted to make a mathematical model mm-hmm. to understand mm-hmm. this system. Mm-hmm. How'd that work out?
Very well. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. So we took a very abstract approach to the encyclopedia. And one of the sources of inspiration for our mathematical investigation was not actually the sociological sciences, but the cognitive sciences. We wanted to look at the encyclopedia and the society constructed around it, not in terms of the interactions of individuals, but in some sense as a group mind, to ask how the system as a whole behaved. We would treat in some sense the society as an unreduced whole. And we wanted to ask questions essentially about the complexity of the thoughts that community had. So that's a very abstract way to put it. And in some sense, we're allowed to get that level of abstraction because of the approach we took. And so let me describe that. So we have a notion of language. We have a notion, for example, of the English language, and in particular, the grammar of the English language. And so depending upon whether or not you're a grammar person, right, we have a certain conception of when a sentence is well-formed and not well-formed. Right, there are sort of limit cases, so should you split an infinitive, but it's very easy to produce an ungrammatical sentence that we would all agree is not grammatical, that we'd say that's not a valid sentence of English. We would know, for example, if somebody who didn't speak English produced that sentence, we would say, you're not ready yet to go on the radio. So we have a notion of a grammar. And one of the questions that came on when linguists tried to make their subject mathematical, quantitative, was how do you describe the grammar of a human language? And in fact, Noam Chomsky, who we know for his political activism, but I think would be famous even if he had never made a political statement in his life, and he would have been famous in part because of his early work in producing a mathematical account of the syntax, in his case, of human languages. So we took some of those mathematical tools and we asked not what is the grammar of all the sentences that people say in, let's say, a cafe. Instead, we took that same mathematical structure and looked at the sequence of behaviors that happen on the encyclopedia. So instead of a sentence in the English language, we look at a day of events on the encyclopedia. And we treat that day of events as, in some sense, a sentence that is spoken by the community. And we ask ourselves, what is the grammar? What is the linguistic complexity of those sentences? So that was the basis of our analysis. We wanted to know, in some sense, if this was a mind, if Wikipedia could talk, what's the nature of its language? Does it have, let's say, a grammar at least as complicated as the English language? Is it more complicated? Is it less complicated? Is it very simple? To give one example, many models in game theory have very particular predictions about how two people will behave in repeated interactions, right? And so the sequence of actions that people take, the sequence of events in that game, are extremely predictable. They're extremely simple. And we wanted to ask ourselves, well, are the behaviors we see in Wikipedia as simple as those game theoretic models? Another example, and just to broaden the space here from human languages and behaviors, you could ask, what is the grammar of birdsong? Birds sing. Particular species have very structured songs. There are some songs they sing a great deal, but there are some syllabic combinations. There are some melodies that these birds never sing. And what you might say is the melodies they never sing are ungrammatical. So put it that way. Say, what is the grammar of birdsong? It turns out, and I think this is still an open question, but by and large, the grammar of birdsong is extremely simple. Birds do not have a language as complicated as human language. But this structure, it's so general that it allows you to put not only things like individual birds singing or individual humans talking or language communities producing lists of what is and is not, say, an English sentence or a German sentence. Right? You can broaden this to the behaviors of an entire system and say, what kinds of behaviors are produced? What are the structures, the interrelationships of the syllables or the words in those behaviors? So we did a statistical study, and we looked, in some sense, at the complexity of Wikipedia behaviors. And what we find, and it's a result that some people say is obvious and some people say is obviously wrong, what we find is that game theoretic models, the complexity of game theory models, is insufficient to describe what happens on the encyclopedia as a whole. The mind, in some sense, the joint behaviors, the mind of Wikipedia, is brighter, is smarter, is deeper than the standard models we have for cooperation, for conflict in human groups.
And so what do you do with that information?
So one thing is you can pat yourself on the back and you can say, you know, by and large, when we've created this society, we've created not just a society that feels nice, but a society that is complex, that has structures to it. One of the ways to phrase the technical mathematical result is that the behavior of Wikipedia has access to an unbounded resource Another way to put it is that Wikipedia has a group memory that persists. So there are different ways to cash out this very abstract statement, which the abstract statement itself is that the computational powers of Wikipedia exceed the finite state. Okay, but the number of different ways to cash that out, in some sense, they're very general. We don't yet have an answer as to exactly why the system is able to produce long-term memories, to preserve memories of, let's say, the correct way to behave. But that's, see, that's too narrative. Because one thing I think we've learned is that societies are more complicated than most of our narratives about them. And the mathematical approach allows you to quantify some of the behaviors that you wouldn't be able to describe in a narrative form because they're too fine-grained, they're too complex. But let's just say that, and we can just say in a very simple sense, that the system has some kind of group memory. We're able to say that that group memory is distributed so that the system's ability to remember and change its behavioral patterns does not persist separately in each individual. In fact, that's something you could have known from a different point of view. The way you would know it is that most editors don't edit very much. People show up on the encyclopedia and disappear pretty quickly. And so the memory of the system doesn't persist in any single individual. It somehow persists in the group as a whole. That unbounded resource, that ability to keep records, to remember, to change behaviors in a persistent and systematic way, that ability somehow arises from the interaction of the agents and not just from individuals, from wise men.
Right. So when you look at, when you say this is a group that has group memory, well, so do societies. Mm-hmm. So can you make comparisons? What is similar and how is it similar to a flesh and blood society where people are interacting and smelling and seeing each other and mm-hmm. so on?
I mean, these are the questions that you want to know. Absolutely. So for example, the social scientists by and large would say yes, of course. Societies do have persistent memories. They do have, for example, social norms. One of the benefits of producing a mathematical account is the absolute neutrality of mathematics. It doesn't matter if you're running this analysis on Wikipedia or you're running this analysis on another project we have, for example, on 200 years of the British criminal court system. It doesn't matter if you're running this analysis on another project we have on conflict in Afghanistan. It allows you to find patterns of behavior that translate into cognitive abilities, these sort of group cognitive abilities, and allows you to talk about those things not just in, yes, nerds hanging out on the internet, right, but also people fighting in Afghanistan. It gives you a sort of bird's eye view of a social phenomenon that, yes, in any particular case, absolutely. Does Santa Fe have institutional memory, right? Does Santa Fe remember things that happened before any of the people living here today were there? Absolutely. We write things down. We persist. We build roads. The roads go certain places. Some roads are paved. Some roads are not paved. These are memories that we've encoded.
And we correct each other, and we have norms that persist from one generation to another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Santa Fe looks different from a small town in New Hampshire. Now, in many cases, the people, the demographics of these two towns may be quite similar. But there are persistent institutional memories that last much longer about how we do things in Santa Fe versus how we do things in New Hampshire. So these are things that we know intuitively. But one of the challenges that we've had in the social sciences is translating this intuitive knowledge, right? Translating that into a mathematical form that you can make predictions with. Another way to put it is this. We do feel good. We do believe in group memory, except when we don't, right? We have a lot of bad behavior. We have a lot of people who forget, right? There's many, many cases in which we don't really care, in which we don't have social norms. Look at Detroit, right? Look at the collapse, let's say, of housing projects in the inner city, right? So there are many cases in which group memory fails, in which institutional, sort of emergent institutions do not form, in which social norms not only are not created, but in fact are destroyed. We have all sorts of examples of this. And so, yes, we believe that societies create social norms and have group memories, except when they don't. And so one of the questions is if we can build a mathematical account of these things, perhaps we can build a mathematical explanation of how they come about.
Well, in the examples you just gave, like Detroit, I mean, they may well have social norms and group memories, but you're pointing to failures and conflicts as opposed to successes in towns that are relatively peaceful.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, certainly and in fact, this is a very nice point, Mary Charlotte, because the simple presence of group memory, the simple presence, again, technically, of an unbounded resource in the cognitive complexity of your social system, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good place to live. It could be an incredibly pathological place. It could be a dictatorship.
When we look at Wikipedia, and when you study Wikipedia, and you see this highly functional system of people who don't know each other and who aren't paid and who aren't getting power and money and credit for what they do and so on, what can that tell us about other systems? How can we learn and perhaps do better in other institutions?
Absolutely. Well, so I think one of the things is that what it teaches us is the importance of social norms that arise from below as opposed to being rigorously enforced from above. It's something that, if we think about it a little bit, so for example, the great statement about America is that it's a nation of laws, not men. But by and large, our encounters with law enforcement day to day are pretty small. You could get away with violating an enormous number of laws, let's say driving in traffic, and you would never get caught. And yet we do. Scott Ortman, one of my colleagues at the Institute, says that even when there's a red light in the middle of the night and no one's around, you don't break it. That's crazy. And yet what it points to is a cultural norm, a social norm that in some sense is more powerful than a legal norm. That's more powerful than, in the physical world, the threat of violence from the state. And so that if we want to build healthy societies, if we want to help societies become healthier, we might learn to respect those social norms and the cultural norms. And Wikipedia is an example where, in fact, almost all of its high functioning comes from the day-to-day invocation and reliance upon social norms, and very little of it comes from a top-down enforcement. One just, and this is not an example that we use explicitly in the paper, it's a bit too narrative, but when Wikipedia was faced with high levels of conflict in around 2005, 2006, and one example is the George Bush page, when that system was faced with high levels of conflict, high levels of conflict, one of the things that they tried to do, the administrators, so people with a lot of had sort of some of the formal software God-given powers, said, "Well, we'll just lock the page. And only us can edit it. Only the administrators can edit it." And the thing was, is it didn't solve the problem. Absolutely, they could lock the page. Nothing happened. And as soon as they unlocked it, conflict returned to these high levels that they had locked the page explicitly to prevent. And so what they found was this heavy-handed, sort of legalistic law, top-down law, didn't work. What they were able to do is find what's called semi-protection, a way of making sure that the worst kinds of behavior was ruled out. But by and large, most people, even if they were behaving antisocially, could still behave and could still edit. And what that level of soft protection, of soft enforcement allowed was the development, the spread, the informal enforcement of social norms as opposed to strict legal rules. So, go.
Isn't that how most of us behave anyway? I mean, most of us in our daily interactions with each other, whether they be socially or at work, we're not worried about being policed. We are being continually influenced and corrected and perhaps correcting others in subtle ways and have been since we were very small.
Absolutely. And yet, when we find a community that's not healthy, we're faced with the question, how much should we rely on legal enforcement and how much should we rely on the development of social norms? And that's been a debate in some sense. That's the left-right split. That's the conservative-liberal split, right? It plays out in different ways, but should we have an enormous police presence in communities that have higher levels of violence? Or should we build more schools?
Well, what if your social norms, for example, are racist norms and everybody accepts them?
This is a fantastic question. This is actually another story I get from Sam Bowles, one of the faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Sam talks about the culture of honor in the American South. So, rates of violence in northern towns, in towns above the Mason-Dixon line in the United States, by and large, the longer residents in that town have lived in the town, the lower the homicide rate is. So towns with people coming in and going out tend to have higher homicide rates. That seems to make sense from our point of view in terms of social norms, right? In terms of repeated interactions and cultures that arise when people persistently interact. So again, if you and I are playing Prisoner's Dilemma together, the ultimatum game together, and we play it every day for 30 years, we'll probably become more cooperative. The thing is below the Mason-Dixon line, there was a study that showed, in fact, that this was inverted. That towns where people had lived for longer periods with each other had higher rates of conflict. And the idea is that social norms about honor, the ways in which you should respond when somebody offends you, had emerged, such that people were fighting with their friends, people were fighting with their neighbors, precisely because they had been able to construct and maintain social norms in favor of, don't insult me, I'm a white man. So absolutely, social norms are not noble necessarily. They are persistent phenomenological features of our world. They're persistent, I wouldn't call them elementary particles, but they're in some sense like the radio waves and clouds in the natural world. They're things that show up in certain conditions that we can manipulate, but are themselves morally neutral.
So the norms themselves might not be morally neutral, but the fact of having norms.
Exactly. So if you go into a community and say, what's the problem? We need more social norms. That's not the answer. We need the right kinds of social norms. What this work tells us, what you know, many sociological investigations tell us in different ways, is that social norms do exist. They can be cultivated. And in some cases, they can lead to healthy societies.
And so taking Wikipedia as an example of a highly functioning society that produces a really useful and good body of information that so many of us use, what it seems like is we can learn lessons from that, but applying them to other systems may be a lot more tricky.
Well, absolutely, right? So certainly the era of social scientific theories that explain, predict, and produce utopias, right? So Marxism is one example, but only the most famous example. That era is over. No one, I think, believes that a correct understanding of a particular social scientific theory will get rid of crime, will get rid of violence, will produce a society in which we're all happy and healthy and never experience pain or suffering. No one believes this. The real question is, given our increase in knowledge, given the fact that we discover and fix our preconceptions about how societies behave, and of course we do that in many ways, we change our intuitions not only by mathematical studies like the one we're talking about, but also by reading novels, also by maturing and living in a full human life. As we increase our knowledge, our command of the phenomena we see around us, that should allow us to build better societies. Now, the translation directly from a single paper, from a single result about the nature of unbounded resources to, let's say, your car not getting broken into at the trailhead, right? That link is not that direct. But again, I think about if we go back to the documents, the letters that, for example, the founding fathers wrote to each other and discussing and trying to figure out how and even what it meant to build a society, to set the rules of a society. Those debates at the time were informed by the best social science that they had access to. And some of that social science was correct. Some of it was flawed. Some of it was racist. And so the next time it comes along to say, well, how should we set up a school board? How should we teach our children? How should we set up a parking lot? Even small things. How should we set up an institute? The more we understand about how people actually behave, the more we understand, for example, about how they play the ultimatum game, the better we might be able to set our rules, to set our expectations, to fit the animals that we are.
Simon DeDeo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.